information. And it certainly, most of what's in a newspaper every day is hearsay, in the sense that you get the description of the guy who saw the man falling off the man tells you what he saw, but the reporter is rarely there when it happens. I happen to think that this idea that you could, that a reporter who did happen on a particular case to refuse to reveal his source of information is somehow interfering with law enforcement, ask yourself this, put it to the test. What is a reporter likely to know that would be admissible in court in the first place? Not very darn much. It's hearsay. Okay. Now, I think another thing that has changed, gentlemen, and I really do appreciate your interest in this matter, because as I've observed this, and this is the first time that I've come down on these hearings, these bills, these four bills that you have before you, really are not the product of the lobbying of newsmen. As far as I know, these bills are pretty much written by legislators who see a need in this country and have responded to it. There is one bill here that is labeled the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association bill. But I think I can truthfully tell you that the way that came about is that some lawmakers said, if you guys could ever agree on a bill that you can all support, we'll put it in, but for God's sakes, tell us what you want. And there is no other statewide news gathering organization that I know of any great size in Oregon except the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. So some people gathered under its umbrella and did try to write a bill, which has since been superseded in my favor by an even better bill. But it was written kind of in a response to a request. A request from lawmakers, as I understand it, who have seen this changing climate of opinion that I've talked about. I have here, for example, a publication of the American Civil Liberties Union that ticks off case after case around the country of attempts to subpoena newsmen, of attempts to subpoena these outtakes that Wally Carson was talking about earlier in the case of the making of the Pentagon television program. This American Civil Liberties Union pamphlet suggests, and again going to one of Mr. Fry's points, it's not just the drying up of sources that you got to be concerned about, it's also the diminishing of eagerness on the part of the reporter to put his neck in the block. And what I'm reading here is something called The Engineering of Restraint, a report of the American Civil Liberties Union by Fred Polich, published in 1971, in which he suggests that if the government prevailed in the Caldwell case, more reporters would decide just not to do a story. Well, the government did prevail in the Caldwell case. And I don't know whether the ACLU is right or not, but if they're right, then this is another aspect of this drying up. The reporters just aren't all that eager, as you noticed from the reporters who were here, to go out and find themselves confronted with a jail sentence. We sometimes have to take that, but we're not looking for it. It has been suggested that there has never been an evidence given of a drying up of sources. Well, this is a little bit like the old joke of asking the district attorney, how many undetected crimes are there in your county? If it's undetected, you can't tell. And if the source is dried up, you'll never know. I can give you one personal example, though, and it may sound silly, but I take it somewhat seriously. I have a barber. And my barber was banging my ear some time ago about what he thought was an outrageous performance by the Portland Police Department in having ticketed a number of cars that were parked during a football game up at Multnomah Stadium in a place where they shouldn't have been parked. His story was that the cops came along after the cars were parked and put up the no parking signs and then ticketed the cars. And he thought that was sort of an outrage. And I said, well, why didn't you call us at the time? And he said, well, because you guys in the newspaper business work so closely with the police department that I thought I'd get myself in trouble if I did. Now, I consider that a drying up of a source, and I think it's a direct example of what can happen if it gets to be thought that the information that's collected by a reporter is going to be subpoenaed by the DA and wind up in front of a grand jury. It may be trivial, but it's a perfectly good example. And I'll give you the barber's name. It's Virgil Warfield. But anyway, the point is, one reason you don't know whether a source is dried up or not is you just never hear from the source. But if I may, I'd like to just close on this. We've talked a lot about civil liberties and about constitutional principles, but let me just tell you how it is, as Mrs. Sullivan did, as a working newsman. Hardly a day, and certainly not a week goes by, but what somebody calls me up. I don't have a Baker Street irregular squad of undercover agents, and my newspaper doesn't. But somehow in Oregon, people regard newspapers and other mediums of news gathering as a kind of ombudsman, as a way to bring things to the surface that really need to be brought to the surface. And hardly a week, as I say, every week somebody calls me And when I was out pounding a beat, I'd run into people in the city hall or somewhere who'd say, hey, have you heard about this? The one example that I'll burden you with was a series that the journal did last year, and I suspect it may have been what Mr. Davis was referring to, but anyway, we did a series written by our medical writer, Mrs. Davenport, about nursing homes. And one of the first points it made was that most nursing homes are pretty well run, and they're doing the best they can with what they have. And you're going to hear that story somewhere else in your 6 months down here. But some nursing homes, it turned out, in Portland, were abusing their patients. They were neglecting them. In fact, one poor guy, by the time we got him up to the county hospital, died. She wrote a series about this. Where did she get her information in the first instance? From relatives and friends of certain patients who called her up and said, I can't say anything about this, and the authorities won't do anything about it, but my Uncle Fred out at the XYZ nursing home is lying there on a bedpan, and he hasn't been taken off for 6 hours. Now, she investigated that, and she had a confidential source, you see. She investigated it. She went out there. She took Gracie Peck with her. They found out it was true. They went to the state records. They confirmed it in the reports that had gone to the state health department. We got some reforms made in the administration of nursing homes in Multnomah County, and Mrs. Davenport, far from spitting in the eye of the public authority, turned over to them. And Carnie Bateson was in charge of this department. All of the information she had, with one exception, and that was the names of the people who came to her and told her about the patients that were in danger. And the reason is obvious. If there is an occasional, very occasional nursing home operator who is neglecting and abusing his patients, what more likely than that he will really abuse and neglect them if he finds out that it was their daughter that blew the whistle on him? That's why she didn't reveal the charges. I think the public was served by that kind of information, and I don't think that law enforcement was impeded. I think it was strengthened by it. Now, the last point I want to get to is the one that has troubled me the most, Senator Fadley, and that's the one about distinguishing between the legitimate and the illegitimate. The possibility that a guy would rob a bank and then write a note about it and paint it on a tree and then refuse to testify. I don't know the answer to that. I do have this feeling that if what we're talking about here is protection of civil liberties, and I'm afraid that I think in this country it's a lot easier to infringe on civil liberties than to protect them. I have the feeling that if you're to err, you would do better. I'm not sure you would be, but you might be. You'd do better to err on the side of writing, adopting the principle of 206 and writing a broad bill. You got, in 2 years, you can come back and do it all over again, and I think that it isn't very hard. You've got lots of models of these bills that, in effect, in my mind, amount to licensing the press, but anyway, very specifically say who's entitled to protection or not. I don't think you're going to find it abused. And anyway, I think if this, the only reason for this is as a protection of civil liberties. And I think that history in this country is that one is better off to err on the side of protecting them than not. We can always fall back. I guess I would have one specific. I will respond to, I think it was Senator Carson's comment. If not, it was somebody asked the question, is this a real threat in Oregon or is it a flash on the horizon? It is certainly not a present threat in Oregon. I can only think of one court case in which this attempt to subpoena information was executed, and we're all familiar with what that case was, the Buchanan case. I had the same request for information that John Salisbury referred to the other a little while back about the question about who shot the lions at the zoo. My answer was not to resist the guy who wanted the information. I said, our files are open to you, and they're the best evidence. Come on up and take a look. We can look at our whole file and what we said about the lions at the zoo. I don't think we're going to be resisting legitimate law enforcement. So it's not a clear and present danger here in Oregon. But after all, gentlemen, you're engaged every day in writing laws down here to forestall for Oregon the troubles that other states have gotten into. The land control bills is a classic example, and the Willamette Greenway. And if you believe in this principle, if you don't agree with what we've been saying to you tonight, with, I think, a remarkable amount of unanimity for a bunch of independent-minded cusses like the news media. If you don't believe in it, then you shouldn't pass the bill. If you agree that there's some possibility of an interference in the ability of people to find out what's going on in their government and in their world, then the fact that we haven't had many cases here in Oregon should not inhibit you any more than you're allowing us to inhibit you in protecting the livability of the state in other ways. And I do appreciate the time and the interest that you're putting in on this matter.
Thank you very much, Don. Appreciate your gestures along with everything else. Senator Carson.
John, I'm not sure you're aware, but Corning Basin has introduced bills to cover the same problem you raised by nursing homes, and that is to hold the information received by nursing homes or by his division confidential. We have the same problem, and the thing I've been agonizing over is that I'm not really concerned with your source, and I think that much of the testimony tonight is misperceived, the thrust of some inquiry. I don't really care who told you. I'm most concerned about the truth.
And rightly so.
And so our goal is, how do we keep the shield from turning into a sword? And there must be a mechanism that we don't have to go the absolute total way of saying whatever you say is fair. There must be intermediate ground. Maybe 206 is the one, and you make a persuasive argument. But our common goal is the truth. The same goal you have, and the same goal I think most district attorneys, and hopefully most juries have, is the search for the truth. And I'm worried in some respects, and frankly, I'm more worried about your political concern than I am about the nursing home, a source close to the president, or a politician who wants to be quoted off the record. That concerns me more than your nursing home of a relative. And yet, how do we protect the public? Where does the right to know stop? Where you say it does, or where the law says it does?
Well, let me say this, and it sounds like a platitude. No newspaper has a right to quote a source close to the president unless it really has a source close to the president that it thinks is a reliable source. We are responsible for everything we print. And in the case that was alluded to earlier of Jack Anderson, he was shown up to be a double-dipped ear blatherskite in that particular case. However, I'll point out to you that he got a Pulitzer Prize six months before that for having access to more confidential information. Which was pretty well accepted as factual about the operations of International Telephone and Telegraph. So you win a few and you lose a few. But I don't think that Anderson should have done what he did in that case, and he admitted it himself. And he is paying the penalty in that. A number of papers have dropped his column completely. I think his general credibility is impaired and his marketability. There is no law now, let me point out, that gives any government body, and God knows I hope we never have one, the power to inquire into the truthfulness of reporting, aside from the laws of libel. Because we certainly do not want to get to the point in this country where any government official is in a position to say, that newspaper isn't publishing the truth, so it shouldn't publish. That's censorship. And I'm not defending, believe me, most false or irresponsible reporting. But what we've always relied on in this country is the free marketplace of ideas. There is the idea that there's a monopoly in the press is baloney. You even have heard Mr. Knotson, who works for the same ultimate employer that I do, come down here and take a different position tonight than I'm taking. We have different opinions. We have in the Portland area alone 30 radio stations, 5 television stations, 2 daily newspapers, and an almost unimpeded flow of magazines that you can't read them all. And I refuse to believe that the American public is so stupid that they can't sort out the bum information from the good information. Now, I'm not going to filibuster you, but I heard this question about the responsible source, or the source close to the president, raised with Dean Rusk one time when he was Secretary of State. His answer was, it was raised by a newsman who said, how come you won't let us quote you by name? This is one of the games that they play. We don't do that here in Oregon, I don't think. But they do, there's sort of unwritten ground rules in Washington that there are certain things that are not for quotation, which means I can't say Wally Carson said it. Others, just background only, and I can write it on my own responsibility, but I can't even say where I heard it. Dean Rusk and an editor said to him, why do you have these rules? Well, the rule was that the guy could say, theoretically, can speak more freely if it isn't going to be pinned on him by name, and the public is therefore better informed, and if he's named in it. Because if it's known that the Secretary of State himself, Dean Rusk, said it, then he's going to embarrass his relations with Zambia. And Russ said, if you don't want to take it on that basis, don't print it at all. You're not required. We're in the newspapers aren't required to print anything. And the responsibility is ours. And if you don't like what we print, you should come to us because we are responsible. We should be held responsible. But I guess what you're saying is that there are those who suspect that these reliable sources don't exist. And I say that if anybody's using that as a cover, that is purely irresponsible journalism. I don't think it's done to any great extent around here.
Are there any more questions?
How will we find out? That's the only question.
Well, Now, nobody's helpless. Incidentally, I was a little puzzled, Mrs. Paulus, by your legitimate question. What about the guy from the highway department who won't tell you sources? I don't think I ever ran into a situation like that. But in any case, if it really were a problem, this man is a state employee, and surely he's under some kind of discipline as a state employee. Now you're getting into the executive privilege problem, which we've also got on the national level. But does this really ever happen? I mean, he's printed a report. It's either factual or not factual. If it's not factual, surely it can be shown that it's not. The answer
is the way the bill is drafted, it would preclude the legislative body from requiring and mandating the source of information the basis of PAMSA put out in public.
Is this a real situation you're talking about? I don't want to argue with my judges here, but I don't understand how this could really come up. He puts out a...
Back down here a few weeks ago.
Well, but you're dealing with a different problem. You're dealing, if I understand what you just said, with the problem of executive privilege.
But the way the bill is drafted, it would include the example I gave, and I don't think it should be left that way.
18 states have it.
Not this bill.
No way. Not this bill.
But they have versions of it. It's the fear of a licensed press that should keep you from going to trying to define who is entitled to a First Amendment protection and who is not.
That certainly is true, Mr. Chairman, as I may go ahead. But if freedom of the press is the reason for this, it seems to be a good deal of overkill to give every person in Oregon who can speak the exemption, and there is that possibility within this bill. Let me proceed. The reason that possibility is not viewed as being real is because you trust the courts, but the reason you are here for an unqualified privilege law is because you don't trust the courts. And I think that the lack of trust in government and the court is the change that has brought the news minister to the feeling they have won an unqualified privilege law now rather than the rough and tumble.
Respectfully, Senator, there's not any distrust of the court. It's a clear and expressly written opinion of the Oregon Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court that this protection, which a lot of people once thought existed, in fact does not, but could be created by the legislature if the legislature chose to do so.
I think that's a fair response to what I said. The change in the climate of opinion may not be as logical as the written words of the opinion when you see a guy in jail in New Jersey because he did disclose criminal activity. You see a guy in jail in Los Angeles because he won't tell who told him that people just become nervous about what the judge is going to do. When you watch Julia Cawthon in a trial, they just get nervous.
Well, and let me, if I may, since you were talking about the question of how broad should the protection be, I think you probably are aware that Mr. Farr, the man in Los Angeles, was not put in jail as long as he was on the payroll of the Herald Examiner. It's when he left first base and started to run the second and left the newspaper business and went to work for the district attorney of all things in Los Angeles County. Then he was out from under the then protection of the California bill, and the judge zapped him at the period when he was out of newspaper employment. Then he went back to work for the Los Angeles Times and was working for the Times at the time his case was prejudiced. Now, what kind of law is it that covers a man when he commits the alleged offense? Well, actually, the offense was not violation of the court order because the court order can't apply to newsmen and never does. It applies to the officers of the court. And what, as I understand that case, the judge, rightly enough, was irate at the thought that the lawyers, who are licensed and who are officers of the court, had violated his order. And what he was going after was somebody violated his order. That's a crime. That's contempt of court. So Farr had evidence as to who did it, namely one of the lawyers, and he brought him in, demanded that he reveal. He said, I can't, I'm sorry, I gave my word I wouldn't. And then the judge got Farr for contempt. But he got him in the period when he wasn't covered by the California Shield Law. Well, if the Shield Law means anything, it's got to care to follow. It does have to follow the man to his grave, because otherwise it provides no protection whatsoever. Now, understand one other thing, if I may. Newsmen do not give this pledge lightly. And it isn't just a general attitude on the part of newsmen that they are never going to tell a law enforcement officer anything. it is under certain circumstances. Usually what happens is the guy comes to you and says, I'd like to tell you something, but please don't tell where you got it. And you say, okay, I promise I won't. And then he tells you. And that's exactly what Farr says happened in history.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, those 18 states that have law include some that are as bad as the California law. We want a better
law. The California law, as I understand, has just been changed to
we have to
be much more sweeping. I have not read
it. It is substantially better in definition, but it still does define nuisance in a more restrictive sense.
All right, and let me, if I may, point out one other thing. That the one case we've had here was not of the estate. I'm not worried about the journal, kind of like Dick knows. I think we generally can take care of ourselves. But notice who was the victim, or who was the person subpoenaed. I won't use the loaded word victim. It was a girl, a student, on a student newspaper. Now, you've got to write a pretty broad bill to cover that kind of a situation.
I think the student newspaper is just as well covered by the kind of
all right, well, I'm glad. And you also have to cover the freelance writer, because a great deal of writing is done by freelancers. And not necessarily for publication in any particular newsman. Now, they take the case of the Seymour Harsh, the reporter who uncovered the My Lai incident in Vietnam. As I understand it, he was not on anybody's payroll, and he peddled that story all over the large newspapers, and none of them would buy it. And he finally got it published in what we've come inaccurately to call the underground press, and then it was finally picked up back into the general news. You have to cover the scene or Hershey, so this thing isn't going to work.
I figure Rampart should be covered.
Well, it should be. I wouldn't be here testifying for this if I didn't think it would.
Norma?
Well, I have one more question that really is directly related to the bill. You know, and I probably will never have a chance to ask the head of the newspaper.
Drop in anytime.
One thing that bothered me from last session we had a young fellow that had been wrongfully accused of a crime, and has been in the newspaper for several days on the newspaper. And after the damage had been done, the newspaper was actually responsible.
I mean, the accusation was by the public official. Is that what you mean?
Well,
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
But there hadn't been any actual analysis. But he was concerned about when he was cleared of the charges, when he was clearly taking a mistake of identity. He wanted us to accept the bill that would require the newspaper to make an attraction, spend much time and energy voicing the attraction. And now I know what the legal responsibility is. Satisfied if you print Jojo is not guilty of the crime and you put up one line in the obituary.
No, excuse me. If you're talking about a libel action, it's not.
No.
It's got to be published in the same place and the same promise.
No, I'm talking about how do you feel morally? What is the moral responsibility?
I concur completely in what you suggested, and I couldn't concur that you'd publish it for 6 days in a row. But I can't pretend that in every case we do this, but I think it's a legitimate point, and if it were put to me, and I'll give you an instance where it was, I mean, I could give you instances, we try very hard on our newspaper to do just exactly that, put it in the same place and the same prominence. The problem would be, I don't know quite how this man was falsely accused, but presumably he was arrested, and there were stories about his arrest.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now, you see, we're in part reporting the activities of a public official, so we share
the. There was more involvement on the part of the reporter, although he wasn't acting in relation.
Yeah.
Well,
this is difficult. We do these, and I think they ought to be done at least with due prominence, let's put it that way. Certainly, if it were a front page item, it would justify a front page correction, in theory anyway. I don't know all the facts in this case. We had one where. There's a erratic person in Portland. We ran a big story on the front page about what he was planning to do with several buildings he claimed to own. The guy called up, that's fine, but he doesn't own those buildings anymore. And we checked it out, and that was right. He doesn't own those buildings anymore. So we ran another story on the same front page. We even made sure that it was exactly the same headline, same type, same width, to get it corrected. Now, that makes us sound awful good, and I won't pretend that we've always done that. But if anybody came to us specifically, because, you know, most of these things never come to the matter of the guy saying, hey, I've really been wrong. But if they did, I personally would try very hard on our newspaper to see that we did just what you suggested.
The strange thing is, Norman, not as many people read the second story as read the first one.
Well, look, there's always going to be error in the press. There's just no question about it, as long as people have a right to speak their mind.
Are there any more questions of Mr. Sterling? I crave the committee's indulgence. We have two more witnesses who have been sitting here for approximately 3 hours and who have driven here from Portland, and I also ask the witnesses to please keep their testimony at a reasonable length, and I'll hear from Paul Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paul Meyer. I'm from the American Civil Liberties Union. Presently, I am privileged to be the Oregon's representative on the national board of the ACLU. I probably have some distinction tonight, and that is I'm probably the only person in this room who has testified on every occasion when the privilege or shield law has come before the legislature, commencing in either 57 or 59. At that time, the chief proponent of the bill was none other than Tom McCall. He came down here, of course, in his capacity as the head of the news department of KGW, Channel 8. He proposed a bill which I believe was at that time in form very similar to Senate Bill 32. At that time, ACLU opposed the privilege, one, because it was not a qualified privilege, but an absolute privilege. And we think that Senate Bill 32 misplaces the concept. If one looks at the privileges that are outlined in the present statute of ORS 44-040, you'll find that they're all privileges that are intended to keep confidential something which is transmitted to somebody for the purpose of his keeping it quiet. That is scarcely what we're talking about in the case of reporters, for whom the information is transmitted for the express purpose of publishing it to everyone else. What was hanging over our heads at the 57 or 59 legislature was the background of the Marie Torres case. Marie Torres was the Herald Tribune reporter who printed a libelous statement about Judy Garland, attributing this statement to a high CBS official. Judy Garland, of course, at that point was seeking redress, not necessarily limited against the Herald Tribune, but also against CBS. In order for her to get at the faceless accuser, she tried, and was successful under court compulsion at least, to require Marie Torres to disclose the name of the person who had perpetrated the libel. And I think that that was in the background, as we can remember, of the McCarthy period, and there was a lot of faceless accusers going on, particularly in Oregon with the general damage provision eliminated by retraction. Sometimes the only real relief a defamed person can get is by finding the person who was the source. And there seems no real reason in the policy of the law to protect a source in that case. That is an example, I suppose, of why an absolute privilege is probably not justified. Now, ACLU comes to you concerned as more or less the Bill of Rights as its constituency, and we've got problems here where First Amendment problems of the rights of the public to know, and I would put it in that context. I think that the newspaper men here are at some disadvantage. This is not, shouldn't be thought of as a privilege law for newsmen or a shield law for newsmen. It should really be approached as a public right to know. And the question of whether this privilege should be enacted in some form should be gauged entirely by the public's right to know. That public's right to know comes into conflict with the rights under due process to obtain evidence that's pertinent to a particular subject or a particular litigation. Now, in trying to figure the cases and how to draft the legislation, I think you have to do some analysis of the competing interests. I suggest to you that it is an entirely different matter when you're talking about the newspaper's function of informing the public and the state acting through a prosecutor attempting to carry out either investigatory or prosecutorial function. In this sense, the press is the people's bulwark against government. And in this case, I think it needs some assistance. ACLU very definitely believes that the press should not be, under any circumstances, treated as an investigative arm of the government. Now, the question was asked by Mr. Fry, why are we here now and why are we concerned about it now differently than we were then? And I think Don Sterling has answered that. And ACLU's response was consistent with that. ACLU felt that the place where the balancing between conflicting constitutional interests should take place would be in the court. That basically we would best likely have a proper resolution of these differences in a judicial context. When we came down in 71 to testify, we testified against a particular bill because we felt it was an absolute privilege bill at that time. We said, however, we supported a bill which would carry out what at that time was the Ninth Circuit's decision in Caldwell, which we think enunciated some of the principles very well of a qualified privilege. Now, what the change was that, as Don Sterling points out, in 1968, the Oregon Supreme Court said the judiciary will not do it. It cannot do it. Now, we thought that decision was wrong. We thought the Ninth Circuit to Caldwell was right. But now the Supreme Court has reversed Caldwell. So in any event, both on the federal and in the state level, we're faced with the fact that in order to put this matter in some place where there can be a balancing, the legislature has to do it. The legislature has to decide in substance what the competing constitutional rights are and the circumstances under which they're to be balanced and the method and mechanism by which they're to be balanced. Now, very briefly, we think that I would give you an example looking at 206. I don't know how this kind of language creeped in to Section 5 of Senate Bill 206, and it's a sort of a comparable thing in Section 2 of 2104, where they attempt to accept out of the privilege the defamation problem. They all talk about, well, at least 206 talks about where the defendant asserts a defense based upon content or source. The Marie Torres case, I think, is a different situation there. The Herald Tribune might not have been asserting a defense based upon the fact they got it from CBS. Judy Garland's need as a litigant to retain full redress was to find out the facts as to who was the source of the libel. I would suggest that it should just be the act does not apply with respect to the source of any allegedly defamatory information in the context where the individual defamed is seeking redress. I think also in the same context of defamation, the legislative...
Do you have rewording or suggested amendments? Would you give it to us? Right?
I don't have it at the moment.
Would you mail it to us?
All right, I'll try. Also, I think that there should be some consideration given of invasions of privacy. In other words, the public's right to know is not really involved in knowing the gossip about which legislator slept with somebody else's wife last night. Well, let's leave the legislator out of it. They're a public figure. And maybe that might be pertinent. But in any event, in terms of an ordinary citizen, this type of information may be an invasion of privacy. And there are circumstances where I think there ought to be remedies for that.
Could we change that to which member of the working press?
Now, in...
I think that ought to be published,
In a balancing, I think that the occasions where a privilege should be or might be overcome, or those cases are, I think they're more compelling where the individual is the private citizen is seeking redress, more so almost than when it's the public. That, I think, is one of the deficiencies of 2104, because if you look there, the overriding compulsion there is if there's a compelling and overriding state interest or a threat to human life. But it seems to me that the state is much better able to get along without seeking the disclosure of information from the press than maybe a private litigant needing relevant information. I'm going to hand out to the committee simply, this is part of the ACLU policy guide.
Can I ask a question about that? What you were saying about handing that out?
Right.
Of course, if a private litigant can force the disclosure, then the public litigant can find out about it. In other words, you have a front man, a private involved.
Well,
and he gets the source.
That is a problem. There's no question about it. What I think that this policy guide does is give you some indications of how at least ACLU as recently as October of 71 has done some of the balancing. Looking down the bottom half, you'll see that they do suggest should be a broad definition, incidentally, and I do concur that there is a validity with what Don Sterling says. Short of the state official, I don't think it should go to cover somebody who's employed by the state. But I certainly think you want to be sure you cover the person who is a freelancer or is a researcher that's working for 10 years on what is going to be a book that will be published. It doesn't need to be defined, and I think Don is being very gracious as a newspaper man, much more so than frequently they might be, in indicating that the licensing laws that might benefit the Journal and the Oregonian, but they're certainly going to play havoc with what really is freedom of press. So I would say that you want a definition that's broad. There should the appearance before a grand jury is quite distinct. With the necessity of evidence in a trial itself. First of all, the proceedings before a grand jury are secret. The implications of what it meant to Caldwell, to just the mere fact of calling him before the grand jury, would, in my opinion, clearly dry up sources. If he had the confidence of the Black Panthers, certainly their knowledge that he was walking in a room where he was being compelled to answer questions, the nature of which nobody would know, would certainly make the sources very suspect. I think, too, the privilege has to go beyond his employment, because the privilege is not for the man. It's for the concept. If the source were to know that all that would have to happen to violate the confidentiality, assuming it is an occasion when it should be protected, is that the newspaper man gets sick and is fired from his job, again, that would be viewing the privilege as a privilege belonging to the newsman, not to the public's right to know. I think I'm not going to go into these specifics here. It's late tonight, and I think in your deliberation you should review these things, because I think each case is different. I'll close with one example of the type of thing that I think is a valid protection. We have seen national network programs on subjects like prostitution and drugs, where they have interviewed various people involved in prostitution or in drug trafficking or in drug use, people who, by the very nature of their testimony, are acknowledging their commissions of crime. Their faces are blacked out, their backs are turned to the camera, their identity is concealed. These programs, in my opinion, have been highly valuable to educate we, the public, to educate us on these subjects, because they've given us insight from a point of view that we've otherwise not been able to get. But consider for a moment what would happen if a zealous prosecutor were to subpoena CBS and demand that they come in and disclose who these people were that helped the public understand the prosecution issue or the drug abuse issue by their appearing on a network. And I think this is the kind of thing that deserves protection, because the public's right to know would seriously be jeopardized if, in fact, there was no protection. I think it's legitimate now to come to the legislature, because the courts have now begged off. They've said they will not, under constitutional terms, solve this problem for us. And we are here, and ACLU is here, to ask you to consider a privilege bill. I haven't had time, and ACLU has not had time, but we will be happy to cooperate with the committee, study the various bills and also any other bills as you might churn out that might be somewhat different than all of these, and at least give you our input as you go along, because we do think, we do represent, and this is strange for ACLU, a nice middle-of-the-road position.
Thank you very much. Mr. Carson. Paul, you made a lot of points with me when you talk about the grand jury and the DA. I think, I don't presume to speak for my colleagues, but I think one of the things that concerned us is where government has turned the press into an investigatory arm for lazy district attorneys. And you put a premium on hearsay. When you go out and repeat the hearsay enough, it becomes reportable, and that becomes evidence for the grand jury. And although there are a lot of problems with the grand jury, and some of them are related to our district attorneys, can we approach it on the basis of, and I sense the ACLU position, or at least as you're indicating, the middle of the road? it would be a privilege but qualified. Is that a
right
fair statement? Can we change the whole emphasis and really won me over to talk about a shield boggles my mind because I think that's the antithesis to the public right to know. Really, that means the public right to know what the press wants to tell them. And that's not really what has been said here tonight. And this is no privilege. It's unlike any other privilege, as you pointed out, that we've ever seen, because it protects who, not what. And the rest of the list of privileges protect what. Can we take a different approach to it? There seems to be some solace in some of the witnesses that 18 other states have adopted. That's never held sway in Oregon. You know, we've done a lot of things that other states have not done, and we've done a lot of things that refuse to do some things other states. I don't know of anything in California or Washington. I don't care to adopt people because Ronald Reagan or Dan Evans indicated that they have been supportive. Can we take it on a different basis? That is, forbid district attorneys from subpoenaing newspapermen unless they have first. We're putting a premium on hearsay, Paul. That's the thing that bothers me.
Well, you're not necessarily putting a premium on a hearsay. The information may be who told you that. Now, that. The person who told it, that isn't hearsay. That might be a source, and the reason they may want it is to obviate the hearsay problem in order to get the horse's mouth into the before the grand jury. So they, you know, I think hearsay doesn't help our analysis here. I do think if this committee comes out with a bill, it ought to deal perhaps separately with the issue of subpoenaing journalists before grand juries, maybe prohibiting it, or at least prohibiting it in the instance and requiring first that there be a court hearing at which the court would answer some of the questions. For example, if you look here at the ACLU statement, they should say there should not be any compulsion to appear before a grand jury unless there is established substantial grounds for believing that he has evidence which is relevant in proving or disproving a crime, that they're investigated and cannot be obtained from other sources without a greater invasion of First Amendment protection. That does set forth some criteria. Looking down further, the case that Bill Frye talked about in Wisconsin is covered here because it does say that he can be compelled to, let me see where it is, if it was here, to give testimony about a crime. Here it is, to testify or produce undisseminated, even undisseminated material relating to planned future crimes involving serious injury to persons and property. So a bill that would say that you can do it for that purpose. But again, I think you're going to have to vest in the court at some stage, and at a very early stage, the duty to make this balancing and decide. I don't want it in the hands of a district attorney, and I do think the legislature has to give guidance to the court. I'm not talking about just saying to the judge, you decide. I'm saying you have to give him the balancing mechanism. In any event, you've got a long job to do, and the way I'm suggesting is the hardest way to do it, because it's not buying a nice, clean package that comes out of a specific interest group. It means doing a job, and I think what Senator Carson says, just because other states have taken an easy route, Oregon, I think, has traditionally upheld a pretty high standard on some of these things, and sometimes our solutions have been better than other places.
When you write as your suggestion, did you also include the definition of journalist? You used it rather glibly.
We'll try.
There's something in the bill that says that by listing occupations, for example.
Right.
Their procedure, I mean.
We'll try.
Thank you very much, Mr. Myers.
Thank you.
Patience. Our last witness is Pat Wilson from KATU.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my comments will be brief for two reasons. I'm rather winded by the previous testimony, although it was rather important to me and to them. And also, that when you are in a business that traditionally gives you a minute and a half to say what you have to say, you get into the habit of attempting to get to your point. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad because of some of this other testimony. I'm also glad to be last because I think my comments will rather capitalize some of the important points that were proposed as justifications for a newsman's privilege here tonight. In a time span of approximately 6 weeks, I was the presenter for my broadcast station of two editorials on this very subject. Of special, and I suppose at first glance, intriguing interest to some persons is the fact that we took a firm stand for a qualified newsman's privilege on December 4th of last year, then on January 22nd of this year, stood four square for an absolute shield, or an unqualified privilege. Well, to us at least, the seeming contradiction in no way expresses doubt in either case about what we wanted to see happen in the way of newsman's privilege. What it does point up is how urgently we felt the need to respond to what we consider to be rapidly escalating evidence that constitutional protections for freedom of the press were being ignored by the courts. Others have indicated that here this evening, too. 2 weeks ago, in Buchanan country, down in Eugene, and we've heard a lot about that tonight, Senate President Jason Bowe said to a broadcast meeting there that he was leaning heavily toward a qualified privilege. Tonight, he says, in part, I have become much more favorably disposed toward a total shield, with, of course, the exception of libel, which indicates that he, too, may be rapidly changing his view. So in a span of 6 weeks, perhaps it's not all so bad that maybe we get a flip-flop. In the case of broadcasters, to us it seemed to be also that there was a new threat from the federal government, the same government which regulates broadcast stations. I'm sure that we're all familiar with the talk by Clay Whitehead, the telecommunications policy director for the present administration, in which he opined that local broadcast stations should be responsible for network news aired on their stations. This is apart from what we're talking about here tonight. But that was a new implied threat that in essence, would mean that the Federal Communications Commission could become a surveyor of what constituted fair and unbiased news, which carried a few steps further, could make broadcast stations mouthers of government propaganda, if it were legitimized by the Congress, which is a complicated way of saying we didn't want it to happen, or even the threat of it. But the current national political climate, coupled with the jailing of newsmen who have refused to divulge their secret sources of information, and a review of misappropriation of power in the past, which in many other countries has resulted in a trammeling of freedom of the press, all combined for us to abandon our earlier stance for qualified privilege for newsmen and wholeheartedly endorse an absolute shield. Now, what I've just said is a capsule form of our thinking that led to our decision. We know that what is being heard here, or was heard here tonight, are arguments on legislation which pertain chiefly to whether a newsman's privilege is necessary at all. We at KATU believe it is necessary. What is at stake is really not a special privilege to a newsman to guard secret sources of information, but rather the free flow of information. If newsmen are forced to divulge these sources, the sources, as it's been pointed out here again and again tonight, could possibly dry up. We believe they will dry up, and if that were to happen, there would be no free flow of information. The public's right to know would be negated. The power structure would be totally in command of, quote, what the public should know, and there would be no free press to help turn the rascals out. I have purposely avoided restating all the arguments advanced here for a shield law, and instead have attempted to give some insight into our station's thinking on the issue. An amalgam of input from the 8 members of our editorial board is in the 2 editorials submitted to the membership of the committee. They state the case for a newsman shield, both the qualified and unqualified, and I rather wish that the argument that we had used for the unqualified was the one that we used for the absolute shield, or I should say the other way around. In 1969 and 1971, it was with regret that we watched bills for newsmen's privilege die in committee here in the Oregon legislature. There was considerable feeling then that such a law was not needed, but now there seems to be new compelling need, and we believe the legislation proposed by Senate Bill 206, or the so-called Governor's Bill, is the bill which should become law in this 1973 legislature.
Good, Pat. Appreciate your patience. Waiting so long. Are there questions of Mr. Wilson?
I want to share about the point. We used to get copies, Pat, of your editorials. And some, I don't have them in the mail, but since the session started, we haven't received copies of your editorials. Is that a new policy?
I'll see to that. It may be
there's
that
a couple I have an interest it, in. The reason I
it may be that there have been some just off the top
of my hand. And if you
you have any further thoughts, please let us know.
All right, we will.
I appreciate the indulgence of the committee, and I should introduce Grant and Karen back here, who is our administrative assistant, and he's from the House side, and Loretta Hill, our secretary, is from the Senate side, if it makes any difference. Yeah,
that's what the Senate is
considerably pretty.
We'll continue with the hearing on the shield laws. We're taking the shield laws as a group, not as individual bills. We won't hear testimony if you want to direct your attention or at any one of them. And the first witness that we have tonight is Representative Keith Skell. Keith, if you're ready, why don't we start in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my name is Keith Skelton. I'm a member of the House of Representatives, and I'm appearing here tonight on behalf of myself. Some years ago, you might be able to impeach my position by saying that I was the attorney for the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. But I don't think I am anymore. At least I haven't had any cases for a long time. And I appear here because of my interest in this particular subject. For many years, I have been either a sponsor or a co-sponsor of a SHIELD bill, and I am a co-sponsor of the bill with Representative Ingalls, which I believe is the full privilege bill that's before you. I'd like to testify a little bit tonight, generally in favor of a privilege, specifically in favor of a full privilege, and talk to you a bit about the theory of what is known as the prior restraint of the press. I'm sure that I was not here at the last hearing, but I'm sure that you heard testimony regarding James Madison and the First Amendment and First Amendment rights and things of that kind. The Supreme Court first noticed, the Supreme Court of the United States first noticed the possibility of what was known as a prior restraint upon the press in the Patterson case in 1907, when they indicated that the First Amendment was to be protected against what is known as prior restraint. Well, now, what is prior restraint? It is some sort of implied or actual threat to the press which inhibits their freedom in the news gathering or news writing procedures. The prior restraint theory was again announced in Schenck versus the United States in 1919. It has been referred to in various other cases, and it is a well-adopted policy in American law. However, we're now seeing a very interesting conflict. We're seeing the conflict between the courts, who are very jealous of their contempt powers and their ability to force recalcitrant witnesses to testify. We're seeing an interesting conflict between that particular interest on the part of the court, which is a interior and selfish interest, as against the interest which they accord to the press under the First Amendment and under the protection of the theory of prior restraint. I understand that the other night my friend Bill Frye appeared before you and talked to you about the Oregon case, which led to the introduction here in Oregon of the first SHIELD bill, not the first, but the most recent fate of SHIELD bills. And I was involved in the Annette Buchanan case, because in that case I filed a brief amicus curiae with the court in behalf of the Newspaper Publishers Association. And perhaps, I don't know what Bill told you the other night because I didn't hear his testimony, but let's get it into focus here this evening, at least from my viewpoint. What had happened was that there was a primary political campaign in which two prominent political figures in Lane County were running for Congress. One of them was Charles Orlando Porter, attorney from Eugene, and the other was William F. Fry, who was the district attorney. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to refer to my brief to refresh my memory, because I set this forth in my brief at that time. In the 1966 primary election, the 4th Congressional District in Oregon was in political turmoil. The holder of the congressional seat, Robert Duncan, was vacating the position to run for the United States Senate. Registration in the district was heavily Democratic, meaning that the winner of the Democratic primary would normally have a large edge in the general election. Democratic politicians began to jockey for the nomination. William Fry was first elected district attorney for Lane County, the most populous county in the 4th Congressional District, in 1958. He received public acclaim and in 1962 obtained the nomination of both parties for the post. In 1966, he was ready for a step up the ladder and he filed for the nomination for Congress. Opposing him in the primary was former Congressman Charles O. Porter, a peripatetic seeker of the seat he lost in 1960. The campaign was bitter. Toward the end, Fry began to attack Porter for past statements regarding Cuba and Red China. The Oregon Daily Emerald took umbrage at this approach and began castigating Fry. Fry struck back strongly on May 20th, 4 days before the election, making a personal attack on the student editor who had been writing the articles against his candidacy. 3 days later, the day before the election, the Emerald editorial supported Porter and criticized Fry. On May 24th, Porter won the nomination, and on this date, there appeared in the Emerald the article written by the defendants, which only 1 week later became the subject of a grand jury investigation by Mr. Fry. And so that's the background of the Annette Buchanan case. Now, in this particular proceeding, Mr. Fry did some very interesting things. First of all, he issued a news release from his office on June 1st saying that he was going to subpoena the editorial staff of the Emerald to inquire about this story. Secondly, the release is sent to the Eugene Register Guard and the Portland Oregonian. Now, this is before the subpoenas are out. This is the story. Third, accompanying the release was a photograph of the district attorney. Later, the subpoenas were sent out. Now, any attorney who is familiar with criminal proceedings and investigations will agree that this is a highly unusual way to handle this matter unless one lives in New Orleans. What was the purpose? I contend that it was publicity. Why publicity? As a veiled warning to other newspapers and news reporters, look out. Now, in that particular case, you gentlemen will recall that Annette Buchanan was held guilty of failing to refuse to answer the questions. She went before Judge Levy. Judge Levy held her that she was guilty. The case went to the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon, and Judge Alfred T. Goodwin, a former newspaper reporter, wrote the opinion that affirmed the judgment of the circuit court in Lane County. And so it was that, as I say, we got into the most recent round of shield things here in Oregon. Now, I believe that a newspaper reporter should have a complete shield. I believe it because if you do not give him a shield, he will tend to stay away from the controversial articles. For instance, at the time, 1966, at the time the Buchanan case was pending, people were beginning to write hidden stories or write stories about hidden facts about abortion. And several of the briefs that were filed in this case refer to articles that were being written then and appearing in the popular newspapers saying, "I had an abortion," unquote, by an anonymous woman, and then recorded by this reporter who talked to an anonymous woman who had had an abortion. Well, query, if the district attorneys, and some of them did, should subpoena those reporters, how many more stories would you get about the problems of abortion? I think there's a second reason, and I'm sure that my friends in the press won't appreciate this reason as well as they do the first reason. And the second reason is that my friends in the press, like I am, are lazy. I think that any of us who have the ability to write a good press release have handed that press release to a reporter, and we have seen it printed in one or the other of the newspapers that we have handed it to, or the news service that we have given it to. It comes back word for word, or that is, if it's well done, or if it isn't particularly well done, or it's changed a little bit, and it comes right back to us again. And it's byline by so-and-so or something like this, and you think he's gone out and done a great job of reporting. Well, all he's doing is that he's getting to be a shuffler of news releases. And I think the problem, and I certainly don't want to assign any motives to anybody, but maybe this is one of the reasons why the publishers are more interested in, or at least in the past, have been more interested in the bill than the reporters have been. Because the publishers want to say to the reporters, "Get out there and get that story." The reporter wants to say, "I don't want to go to jail, boss." But there is something about this. I think that our press, I'd like to see more investigative reporters. I am saddened that we don't have more reporters out doing a good job of investigation. As I understand it, the Oregonian doesn't have an investigative reporter on staff. Or maybe one. The Journal has, as I understand it, one investigative reporter. Now that's a pretty sad thing for a state like this with two large daily newspapers in a city like Portland, and I'm sure there are things to be found that are not found in press releases in Portland. I think that we need to have more investigative reporters. And if this bill would have no other thing, would have no other salutary effect than to get some more reporters out doing some tough investigation work, I think it would be just great. And for that second reason, and I don't know whether that's been given to you before or not, but for that second reason, I want to again say that I hope that Oregon does take heed of this problem that we face and pass a strong shield law. I'll be glad to answer any questions or engage in colloquy or debate.
Are there any questions, Representative Kelly? Colloquy, but not debate. Bill Frye did not mention the Buchanan case, although others have, as such, in questioning of him. I asked him if the effect of that was not, is it not true that the effect of that was to dissuade people from printing stories about illegal activities which were widespread? And I said, "Do you believe that she would have printed that story if she'd known she'd go to jail?" And he said no. And then I said, "Do you mean that the effect of that was that they would not have printed the charge that the use of marijuana was widespread?" And he agreed that that was probably the case.
Interesting.
I thought it was the most interesting part of his testimony was that he seemed to say that the notification of the public of a condition which they otherwise might not have known about generally would have been suppressed by his activity.
Well, you see, that's what comes of having a good lawyer's mind, Senator. I wouldn't have thought of that.
I was trying to answer it.
Yeah, that's very good. Candidly. Mm-hmm.
Are there other questions?
Mr. Scott, would you like to take a shot at defining a report?
I know that's the sticky problem. I think that a reporter has to be someone who is regularly engaged in his occupation, either as a staff reporter for somebody or as an independent working for himself, but regularly engaged in the news gathering business. I don't think that a person who works for a weekly shopper is a reporter, unless he is reporting news. If he's reporting news items, he is. I think that news, the term news is enough of a term of art today so that we shouldn't have too much of a problem with that. And certainly reporters should, and reporters of all media should be treated equally. The written word, the spoken word, the pictured word, any of them.
Would you also give the same shield and privileges to a PR person for the government?
No, he's not a reporter. He's a publicist, and there's a difference.
You can define the difference between a publicist and a reporter.
I can, at least in my mind, and I think I could get it, put it into words if necessary.
Keith, what about the Thomas Paine type pamphlet here?
That's getting a little closer. But is he a propagandist now? Is he reporting news? Thomas Paine was not the Jack Anderson of his day. He was not out investigating and reporting to the general public what he was finding out in his investigations. He was urging the general public on to higher acts of violence and against the good order and so on and so forth. he was not even a muckraker. He was a propagandist. And I think the same as them too.
Mm-hmm. Are there further questions for Representative Skelton? Appreciate your stand down.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're seriously considering this measure. It's been before us for a long time, and I hope we can do something about that. Thank you.
Next, we'll call on Senator Staley.
Thank you. If you don't mind, I'll just stay here. Actually, I'm testifying for a constituent, Irving Brandt, who's the author of the Bill of Rights, a book, and recently, I believe, received the McNaughton Award for Civil Liberty. He asked me Saturday afternoon to come by and pick up his testimony. It's in the form primarily of repeating things which he has said or written other places. I'm quoting him now. During my 62 post-college years, I have spent 32 years as reporter, managing editor, editorial writer, and editor of small city and metropolitan St. Louis and Chicago newspapers, and thereafter 32 years as writers of books, 12 of which deal in large part or entirely with constitutional history and law. From that background, I wish to testify in support of legislation to protect newsmen from compulsory disclosure of the source of published information under a pledge of confidentiality. My statement falls into three parts. One, remarks by me on that subject at a public forum in Eugene on January 21, 1973. Two, a letter written by me to the Washington Post, published November 27, 1972. Three, a few case histories personally observed. In my Eugene speech, I said that the Supreme Court's modification of the Miranda decision hurts only the unfortunates of society, and went on as follows. Something else, however, is hitting all of us right between the eyes. That is the blow the Supreme Court has recently delivered to newspapers, magazines, radio, television, and thereby to every man, woman, and child in the United States. I allude to the multiple decisions requiring reporters to reveal the source of information given them under a pledge of confidentiality. One argument for disclosure is legitimate but not compelling, the need to apprehend a fugitive or put a useful witness on the stand. The most pervasive motive is illegitimate, the desire to punish somebody for revealing corruption in government or blundering in public policy. A third motive for forcing disclosure describes itself, sheer judicial arrogance. That is strikingly typified by the 48 days imprisonment of Los Angeles reporter William Farr, found guilty of contempt of court by a judge intent on public punishing an unidentified lawyer who disobeyed a no-talk order that is several years moot. This swollen-headed Los Angeles judge based his action on three simultaneous Supreme Court decisions of last June. Dividing 5-4 with all of the Nixonians in the majority, the court held that the constitutional guarantee of freedom of the press does not prevent a grand jury from compelling disclosure of the source of confidential information obtained by reporters. The court ignored the fact that if confidentiality is lost, the news sources dry up. Virtually every revelation of corruption in government begins with a secret tip from an honest source. No more of that. What man will risk his livelihood on the chance that a reporter will needlessly go to jail after jail becomes the inescapable penalty of hopeless martyrdom? These Supreme Court rulings are established, have established, automatic pre-publication censorship of newspapers, radio, and television on a gigantic scale. What do the four Nixon justices and Justice White think of their decision on news sources now that Tin Horn judges and Malcolm Cole prosecutors are ganging up on newspaper reporters all over the United States? Unless these decisions are reversed, we shall see press, radio, and television sinking in innocuous passivity where freedom of information is concerned, or we must rely on the willingness of reporters to rot in prison for constitutional principles and the good of the public. My letter to the Washington Post, November 27, 72, follows, quote, jailing reporters. In three successive decisions, the Nixon appointees to the Supreme Court, with a vital assist from one predecessor, have held that the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of the press does not keep newspapers out of prison for refusing to tell who gave them confidential information. Reporters, the judges say, are not agreed upon, but that is exactly what the decision makes them. Lawyers, even without the First Amendment, cannot be compelled to testify about their relations with clients. Doctors enjoy a similar immunity concerning their patients. Reporters, the Supreme Court holds, are different. They owe a duty to society which overrides the constitutional guarantee of freedom of the press. What is the real ground of distinction? Custom, the new versus the old, nothing more. Lawyers, being lawyers, set up their immunity themselves, for themselves, sometime after Cain killed Abel. Doctors obtained it as a grant from the god Apollo to his son, Dr. Esculapius. But where did freedom of the press come from? It was planted by John Lilburn in decaying organic matter during the decade and a half before and after 1600, when Queen Elizabeth, Archbishop John Whitgift of Canterbury, Attorney General Sir Francis Bacon, and the Court of Star Chamber were uniting their talents and dictatorial authority to suppress internal quotes, seditious and schismatical books and libels. Those internal quotes. Libels in that day meant pamphlets. Inch by inch, century by century, freedom of the press has pushed its way up into the sunlight in spite of occasional killing thoughts, as at present. Here is a thought for the Supreme Court. If Queen Elizabeth, Archbishop John, Sir Francis, and their associates had put as much zeal in the protection of a free press as they did in destroying it, and if the medical profession were of the 20th century origin, reporters today would have complete protection of their sources of information, and doctors would be compelled to testify about their patients. Lawyers, of course, would retain their self-bestowed immunity regardless of circumstances. During my 32 years as reporter, editorial writer, and editor, I never heard of such a thing as forcible disclosure of news sources. In 1910 or thereabouts, my father, publisher of the Iowa City, Iowa Republican, received a letter from Frank Novak, who for something over 15 years had been serving a life sentence for murder. He was writing, he said, because my father, then with the Cedar Rapids Gazette, had written the only unprejudiced account of his trial. My father thought he was innocent, but would have written fairly anyway. In the penitentiary at Fort Madison, Iowa, Novak became prison librarian and developed into a suburb portrait photographer. Now he hoped for a parole, which in that day only the legislature could grant, and desperately needed it because my boys are growing up and getting wise. The ensuing correspondence led Novak, after a time, to write that although he was well treated, conditions in the penitentiary were terrible, filth everywhere, food rotten, and neglect extreme. My father wrote a series of articles based on Novak's revelation. Every accusation was denied, followed by correction of conditions. On one occasion, a statewide delegation was brought in to inspect a butchering shed which had been described as stinking with rancid fat. It was shiny clean with no trace of wear. My father picked up a sawed board end and remarked to a prisoner, "The building looks new." He replied that it was built last week. Novak obtained his parole and became a successful photographer in Chicago. He would have died in prison if the source of my father's articles had been dragged out of him. There was no attempt at that. Such a system of law enforcement had not yet been dreamed up. In St. Louis, about the year 1935, the St. Louis Star-Times charged that a prisoner had been beaten to death by guards in the city jail. "Fellow prisoners did it," the city authorities replied. Every particle of evidence came either from the jail inmates or employees, but again, no main demand was made for disclosure, as it would be today in the wake of the late Supreme Court decision. Eventually, the jail authorities caved in. In that same decade, the Star-Times barely escaped winning a Pulitzer Prize in a city that contained a Pulitzer newspaper, with a series on fearful conditions in county courthouses throughout Missouri. Again, there were denials, but no attempt to drag out the inside sources of information. The judicial stage had not been set for that. Now it has been. The United States Supreme Court has given the country a choice between immunity of reporters from forcible disclosure, exclusion without loopholes, and the virtual demolition of the First Amendment as a bulwark of the people's right to know what is going on in government. Signed, Irving Brandt, 1575, Ferry Street, Eugene, Oregon. I was, as a person representing a constituency of the food, Mr. Brandt, I'd like to adopt his statement as my own. The change in the attitude of judges, or at least the law of the matter, seems plain. Oregon has only seen one incident where anybody has had complaints, and that reassured me that there would not be many incidents of journalists using the privilege in a case where there was real concern and any real lack of knowledge about the nature of the source. There may be a question, Mr. Chairman, about what is a newsman, and I think that Bob Davis's answer to that question, although perhaps the language is inexact, is a good answer, and that is that we can expect the court to apply the definition of a newsman and news on the basis of common sense and past experience and do fairly well with that. This proposal and my conclusions about it do not necessarily protect free speech, as broad as it may be. Everyone has the right to speak freely and to suffer the consequences of that. Instead, it would protect a specific profession whose stock in trade is the First Amendment right to free speech. And that being true, I would certainly adopt what he has to say with the understanding that it applies to those people, whoever they may be, who are in the news business.
Other questions or something to say? I find a strange parallel between your adopting Mr. Brandt's statement of your own and his ridicule of the Supreme Court. If you have confidence that the courts will rule wisely in the definition of reporter.
I don't have so much confidence that they will, as I am not sure that we can draft a definition which is complete along that line. And I did want to say that it is the stock and trade of the journalist in the use of free speech rights that is to be protected here and to shield it here, rather than the right of anybody to say anything on the plain being told us by something before.
Other questions? If not, we'll call on the next witness, and this is Paul Meyer, APLU.
Some trepidation that I follow Irving Brandt.
I only wish that when I'm 87 or 88 that I can be as eloquent and as vital and as alive as that gentleman is, and I'm proud that ACLU awarded him with the McNaughton Award, E.B. McNaughton Award, a year and a half ago. I come down to follow up, one, because your chairman last week asked that we do some work, and two, the intervening week has given us an opportunity to review the bills, and particularly the governor's bill, Senate Bill 206, which had just come off the press immediately before the last hearing. I will say that the product of what you have before you tonight in terms of specific suggestions, I've had the assistance of two lawyers in Portland who are affiliated with ACLU, with whom I think are well known probably to many of you, John Butler of the firm of Cake, Draghi, Hardy, Butler, and McEwen, and Tom Deering from that big office known as We the People, or Davies, Biggs, Strayer, Stoll, and Boley. In any event, the first thing we did was to wrestle with the question of definition, which you asked. We looked at it, and incidentally, we all came up with an interesting conclusion that the Senate Bill 206, despite its seeming simplicity on first reading, was actually one of the best drafted bills that we have come across. There's an awful lot of work, I think, in this, and its simplicity is perhaps misleading. In looking at the troublesome definition of medium of communication, we concluded that the drafters here, for some reason, had slipped and not even followed the pattern that they set in the subsection 1 of section 2, where they use the phrase, and as well as in 3, information has its ordinary meaning and includes, and then they go on. Processing has its ordinary meaning and includes. The problem with number 2 was that it just said medium of communication includes. It didn't even have a definition to which include was an explanatory clause. And we felt that that could be cured by using the drafter's own language and insert the word has its ordinary meaning and includes, and go on as the way it is. Now, what we think that does ties in with what Senator Ed Fedele just said, and that is that it becomes very difficult, it seems to me, for the legislature to define precisely what constitutes the person involved in media communication who is covered by this bill. The courts are going to have some leeway. And it seems to us that a definition such as has been built up here gives the court a rather good tool to see that this is not misapplied. The interesting thing is, and it's really a beautiful job of drafting, because when you get down to the section 3, the word is called person. But what you're describing is sub 1 and 2 of 3 about disclosing the source of published or unpublished information, and it uses medium of communication. It uses all of these things above, which do, I think, import some traditional meanings, and meanings which I think the court can get a handle on, and in all probability do better at it than this legislative group trying to sit down and wrestle with definitions that it should be a reporter who is engaged by some newspaper of a certain degree of circulation, or he receives so much money, or he is avocationally or professionally engaged, and try to give some series of tests. Frankly, we're very pleased with this, and I think with the suggested, what I think must have been almost an omission of the original drafter, we almost bring it back into a very good form. Now, the other thing is the Section 5, and here's where we feel the governor's bill fell down, and perhaps rightfully so, because this was written from the point of view of trying to establish the privilege, and maybe insufficient attention had been paid to the occasions when the privilege might legitimately not apply. And if you'll turn to page 2 of our statement, I would review with you just very briefly the 5 occasions that we have outlined here.
Everybody have a copy?
No.
Okay.
Does everybody have a copy?
Everybody? I have. All right. The Section 5 now existing recognized only one exception relative to defamation, and apparently limited in a way which I can only assume came from some other source, because I've seen this language used elsewhere, based where the defendant asserts the defense based upon the content or source. As I indicated last time, there are occasions when the person may not be suing the newspaper at all, but want to get to the original source of the defamation, and therefore the requirement of seeking the source of the defamation printed in the newspaper may very well require in another action that the reporter reveal the source in order to assist the same person to get his redress. So we have placed A to be in a civil as an exception, but the privilege would not apply in a civil action, not a criminal action. We're not going to get involved in criminal libel now. In a civil action for damages for defamation to the source or content of any published or unpublished information constituting all or part of the allegedly defamatory material or constituting evidence relating to malice. And I don't think the press is going to be too upset at the possibility that that kind of redress is open to a person injured by their activity. Again, we're talking here about whether it's desirable to protect the press in a context where it is actually damaging an individual. And of course, defamation has historically been an exception to the First Amendment. B extends the same exception to damages for invasion of privacy. Now, invasion of privacy is an established tort. It's a relatively new tort. It was virtually invented by Justice Brandeis in an article he wrote in 1893, in which he set forth the basic concepts of the right to privacy. We don't need to fear this as a very great exception. The right of privacy virtually is non-existent for public figures, unless it relates to matters about a public figure that are so old and outmoded as to have no relevance or relationship to present activity or conduct. As far as other people are concerned, the ordinary citizen, it's been established. In any event, if the paper is by publishing gossip or things that really do invade somebody's privacy, there's no particular reason why the person should not get relief. I'm going to drop to E, because E is a little bit easier to comprehend. E says that the privilege does not apply to the right of any defendant in a criminal proceeding to compel a person to produce or give testimony concerning published or unpublished information, or the source of either, which tends to establish the innocence of the defendant of the crime for which he is being tried. Suppose, for example, that a reporter during the course of a trial publishes a story that the defendant is really the wrong guy and that he has information that somebody else was responsible for the crime. The Sixth Amendment says that a defendant in a criminal trial is entitled to compulsory processes to obtain evidence in his favor. And it would seem that in that situation, unless we do establish an exception here, there might be seriously a constitutional question as to whether this privilege does not compete or violate the right to produce evidence in your favor. And it would seem further that there is a compelling overriding reason in this instance to permit the defendant access to this information. Now, you'll note in all of these three situations that I've discussed so far, we're not talking about the state's right, the district attorney or the prosecutor or somebody in governmental power, except being able to overcome the privilege. We're talking about the individual citizen or the defendant in a trial who has been damaged or who might necessarily be helped. I think all of these are valid exceptions to the privilege. And I suspect that upon analysis, you won't get too much resistance from the paper and the industry, the news industry, and the media industry to these exceptions. Looking at C and D also involve, on this point, evidence which we don't think really is comprehended by what is intended by a privilege. First of all, C relates to information obtained by a person witnessing an event in a public place involving serious injury by one person to another person or another's property. Now, that's rather carefully drafted, and I'll try to explain the significance. The reporter is an eyewitness, whether this be a serious automobile accident or whether it be the police batting heads in at Portland State. And somebody needs the evidence as part of his redress. It could be that the state needs the evidence to prosecute somebody for improper conduct. Clearly, a person, and in this case we're talking about the news person, who witnesses this in a public place, is not obtaining this information under any idea that it's being transmitted to him in confidence. I think it's a less dangerous way than to try to qualify the bill with the concept that you're limiting it to material given in confidence. Now you ask, why then the qualification on this involving injury by one person to another, serious injury by one person to another person or another's property? First of all, we think that we don't want reporters brought into court unless they have witnessed, I'm looking at the wrong one. Let's say a reporter like Caldwell or Annette Buchanan goes to the meeting where she learns about marijuana smoking on a campus and walks outside with the people she's just spoken to, having seen them in possession of marijuana, and now she's outside and she's observing them smoke and it's in a public place. Well, we don't think that the privilege at that point should be ripped away. It wouldn't be under this test because she's not witnessing an event in a public place which involves a serious injury by one person to another person or another's property. If it were, if going outside of this in this context, she witnessed somebody knifing somebody else, then the privilege would not apply. The other exception D talks about information obtained by a person witnessing a crime. That's distinguished from an event in C, involving injury by one person to another or another's property in any place. If Annette Buchanan, in the course of interviewing these people who are acknowledging the commission of a crime, if at that point one of them assaults or pulls out a knife and stabs the other, that she would be in a position of having to report. Now you have to go down now to number two to see the consequences, or at least the applications, because there we said none of these exceptions shall apply to permit compulsory appearance of a person otherwise covered by this act, or to require production of any unpublished information or the source of published or unpublished information before any grand jury or legislative or executive body conducting a closed hearing. Now that, in effect, says while we have these five exceptions, they will not permit the reporter, if we can use him as a shorthand for person that's covered by the act, to go before a secret body to be used for that, because the mere fact of being compelled to go before the secret body is likely to be an inhibition on the type of information or the right of the public to know. Now there is a situation here, and there are some situations, take number E, where you could say, how will there be a determination of whether the person has testimony which tends to establish the innocence of the defendant? We didn't spell it out here, and we think it need not be spelled out, but if legislative history would be important, our idea would be that if the defendant wanted to subpoena the reporter under E in his trial, that at that point, if the reporter contested that he had this kind of information, there would be an ability of the reporter to move to resist. on the grounds that he didn't have evidence. At that point, there very well might be an appropriate closed hearing before the judge to determine that issue. Closed hearing in the sense that not closed entirely, but where the parties might be present. And then if the court determined that it was a possibility that he had evidence that would assist the defendant, he could then compel the testimony. Now, I've outlined in the latter part of our letter one exception that we determined not to include, that we gave some thought to. And that was one of the things that troubled us in Mr. Fry's testimony and in some of the other members of this committee. And that is the question of reporting future crime. Now, we set out in here why we think that on balance it would be better to protect the reporter even where he publishes that next Tuesday the First National Bank is going to be robbed or the bank will be bombed. We've tried to suggest that the only source of such information is likely to be somebody who's part of the gang, who might not be happy with what is going to be done because he's out of sympathy with the violence or with the harm that he thinks might happen. He doesn't want it known that he's spilling the beans, because if he is known, he's not long for this world, assuming he's in with some pretty bad people. The reporter can print that information, or indeed the reporter can tell the police about the information. But whichever he does, it's our feeling that society is better off for knowing about it than it would be if they didn't have the information at all. And we think that that's really the balancing that occurs there. And if that's the balancing, you have to decide it's better for us to know about a future crime than perhaps to discourage the ability of the press to be an instrument of uncovering it and exposing it and alerting the public to a future planned crime. Now, I'll be happy to discuss any of these specifics with you, but I do want to assure you that there has been a considerable amount of thought to these things. If this Bill 206 does take into account these problems, then ACLU is prepared to support this bill.
Are there questions of this
In trying to take care of the situation about defamation, don't you get people in a box where anytime they want to protect their source of information, you can impute malice to them? In other words, wouldn't they be better off really without this exception here? I know that the Newspaper Publishers Association had a different exception covering malice, and I thought that that was probably an effort to say we really aren't personally financially interested in the outcome of this legislation. We're not going to have an exception for libel. I seriously think that any time you have an exception involving a potential evidence of malice or a defense an action for libel, if you have the exception and the reporter still has his or her standing and won't disclose, that you put the reporter in the newspaper in a box where people are going to impute malice to them. They have an exception. They're told they have to answer, and they still won't do it. And the jury is going to take that as malice right away.
Well,
but wouldn't they be better off without the exception? Wouldn't we get more truth without it?
No. We don't know. For example, a newspaper may have the source of information which is published. Mm-hmm. It may have in its files 10 letters from reputable people, all of whom say this is absolutely untrue. And yet the newspaper chose to believe, let's say, a very disreputable source in the face of all this evidence, unpublished, that it was untrue. Now, we think, balancing that, the defamed individual should have access to that evidence. The problem also comes up in the fact that there may be a desire or a necessity of the defamed person to seek remedy against the person who was the source. For example, if the Willamette Bridge, protected by an immunity which is flat broke, is guilty of printing a defamation that comes out of Georgia Pacific, you can be assured that if you are the defamed party, you're going to want to sue Georgia Pacific. You could care less about the bridge. But if the only way you could get evidence as to who and why and how Georgia Pacific was the source of that, which has now been published and republished, then you would have to get access to the Willamette Bridge reporter and the material on which he based it.
You've assumed that when the reporter is hailed into court, he'll answer the question, and I've assumed the contrary.
Well,
in your case of the judgment-proof publisher, that's just beside the point. But in the case of the Oregonian, if the reporter says, "I won't tell," and my boss can't make me tell, and I'm not going to, as part of my professional responsibility, tell you I'm not going to tell who my informant was, it seems to me, by giving them the exception, allowing you to the court to say you must disclose this, you have proved malice. When, as a matter of fact, all it is a reporter protecting his source.
Well, if you limited it to malice, and if you wanted to put something in a bill that a failure to or an insistence upon the privilege is conclusive evidence of malice, or even presumptive evidence of malice, but you still don't get to the fact that you may need it to have access to the defamatory material or the source who is responsible and should be subject to redress.
Yeah, well, I agree that you need it to get access to the information. In any case, I don't see why this is a greater case than the other case.
Well, the reason I think it's greater is that you're again talking about those occasions on which press actually hurts people. And in my opinion, where you have the press hurting people, then the purpose of encouraging this type of information doesn't exist. I don't think there's any policy in the law of the public wanting to know defamatory material about somebody. What is the public purpose being served? As Don Sterling, I think, said very well, we're the press and we are still retaining and maintaining the responsibility of the accuracy of the material we print. I don't think they're asking for any further immunity. They've got enough of it as it is when they're not liable for general damages once they've retracted. They've got a great deal of protection. Sometimes that's precisely the reason that the defamed person has to get to the source, because the source may be able to respond.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question on this. I don't want to monopolize the conversation, and it may be that the politics of the matter are contrary to the logic of the matter, so I don't want to waste too much time. But I would point out to you that if Mr. Fry had wanted to, he could have brought a civil action against the Buchanan. Say, the Supreme Court of the state in favor of Langley has said any district attorney who doesn't know, who knows of an offense and doesn't prosecute it, should be thrown out of office. Mr. Buchanan has alleged that his widespread use in my jurisdiction of marijuana, everybody knows about it, and she has defamed me because her words have cost me my job as a criminal action. Now, she might not have gotten anywhere with the jury with that, but she could have said that. And then they were in court and required her on pain and contempt to answer the question, who told you this? Who are those people? As a plaintiff, and we do have district attorneys in my county who are plaintiffs in civil.
The only answer I can give, and we wrestled with this a little bit, and that is that in any civil proceeding, there are present existing statutes for protection of any witness, a protective order. And at least you can get before a judge and determine, and frequently courts will protect a witness from having to give a deposition, for example, let's say, until some issue is decided. For example, there's always a question of demurring the complaint, establishing whether it's a bona fide cause of action. And I think that what we would have to look at in some of these situations is the right of the press, if they were being abused, if one of these procedures were being abused. They do have a procedure to go in front of the judge for protective order, and if they could show that the lawsuit is frivolously being brought solely for the purposes of trying to defeat the privilege that otherwise would exist, there are ways in which the law can accommodate that, I think, without trying to write it into this bill.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Meyer, there appears to be a very fine distinction between C and D. And I'm wondering if you could speak to this a little more. C seems to refer to the event in public place as opposed to crime in any place.
Yeah.
And yet your example that you gave us, the speed involved in knifing after you got out of a private meeting, and that was thrown into D.
All right, let's, yes, I suppose it would be in D. C would cover civil wrongs as well. In other words,
why are you restricting it to a public place in C?
Well, originally we thought of C. In other words, there are events that people observe in public, even reporters, where the information is not particularly coming to them under a privileged circumstance. Even so, we think that if they, for example, observe certain types of conduct, even if it's in a public place, unless it involves a serious injury by one person to another, and we're deliberately using that language to eliminate the victimless crime, we don't think that the reporter should be used as investigative arms. Of course, they can't be brought before grand juries anyway under this proposal. But if they observe somebody going into, it's like abortion before the Supreme Court ruled that most of our abortion laws were unconstitutional. Reporters got information about abortion. Somebody mentioned that earlier. Drug abuse is another example. The victimless crimes of not requiring them to report. We then evolved that, well, what about the reporter who goes in he's invited in to a home to learn about, say, the Black Panthers, like Earl Caldwell. And while he's there, one person assaults the other person. And the person who was assaulted brings a civil action against the other guy for damages. He could obtain the reporter as a witness for him. Or the prosecutor, if he prosecuted, could obtain the reporter under those circumstances. But that's in open court. And it was just felt that we just couldn't see where that hurts the privilege. Now, maybe we're wrong. And we did think that it may be that that evidence would be necessary.
Maybe you
misunderstand. I'm sorry, did I misunderstand your question, Jerry?
Maybe a portion of this one is why you limited C to a public place. If information came by witnessing it in a public place, would it not be a valid witness in a private place?
Well, there's some slight difference in wording. First of all, if it's in a private place, we suggested it had to be a crime rather than an event. And we dropped the word serious. Now, I don't think these are matters of the greatest moment in the world. This is one version, and maybe somebody wrestling with it would combine C and D into some all-inclusive statement. It did seem to us there might be some distinction between what's observed in a public place and what is observed in a private place. It just is that what's observed in a private place is more likely to be involved in the concept of confidentiality than what's observed in a public place. Maybe the distinction is a too subtle a one.
Are there further questions? Mr. Meyer, when you came last week to call me by asking for a qualified field bill, and you were pretty much told I'm playing 104, and then when you come tonight, you propose it again by supporting two of the Sixth Amendment. I've had my suspicions about the ACLU for quite some time, but it really good in this.
Well, I don't think I supported 2104 because I suggested there that we didn't like the concept of overcoming the privilege to meet a compelling and overriding state interest. It seemed to us that that practically threw out the privilege altogether. It was very vaguely worded, and frankly, I thought we tried to draw a distinction between our concern of the individual as in terms of his being hurt by the press and the state. And I think that's consistent with what we've said here, because basically we're saying let the state do its own investigation, let the state not appropriate the press as an investigative arm of the district attorney or the police. And frankly, in reviewing this thing, we've had some change of heart. We think that the approach of 206, if we can spell out, now there may be other sections, there may be other exceptions that this committee feels are valid. We would suggest that the committee go through the process we've gone through, and that is to try to analyze each specific situation where you feel, as we've tried to do here, the purpose of the privilege is overcome by some other important activity or requirement of due process. We've expressly refused to include one exception that we had previously thought might be included, this business about future planned crimes. Because on balance and thinking that one through, we concluded it's better the public know than to dry up the source of knowing. Particularly since the source of that knowledge is likely to be somebody who is part of a conspiratorial group who, becomes turned off on a particular crime.
Well, I for one appreciate very much the work that you people have gone through to help the committee in this area, because the committee, I think, will miss you.
Paul, I share about President Cole's concern with D in the way I read it. Would have to have had the act challenged as a crime and decreed as a crime before that had come into play. Is that right? Or does that, am I not reading it in conjunction with C?
Well, I'm not certain that I wouldn't be happy with C instead of a public place in any place. I think if it involves a serious injury by one person to another person or another's property, probably that's sufficient protection. And maybe the committee will struggle with C and D and want to combine them. I do want to eliminate the possibility of victimless crime as being defined in there. I think it should be harmed by one person to another person or his property. The word serious, it seemed to me, was reasonably appropriate, simply that we don't want reporters subpoenaed in where the injury might be only trivial. Now I can't. You're leaving some problem of a court defining what is serious. On the other hand, we don't want the privilege invaded unless it's really important to somebody to have to get that information. And we don't think either the state or the individual injured. It's that important to get the reporter involved unless it's a serious injury. Now, maybe there's a better word than serious. Maybe substantial is a better word than serious. But in any event, the guy just brushes beside somebody else and nobody's hurt, it would not be an occasion to force him in to tell what happened at the meeting. But maybe there can be some work by the committee to combine C and D. Again, we would ask that you keep those guidelines of harm to someone else, one person to another, and some degree of serious or substantiality in what the harm is.
Upon C and D, are you not treating a reporter just the way you would anybody else? It isn't really relevant to their work, and they're not concealing anything. It's just any other witness to an event, isn't it?
Well, first of all, you have to go back to your definition. Three only protects the person if it's something he's gotten in the course of his work. So we're talking about a reporter differentiated from other people because other people wouldn't be. Thirdly, we have taken away in Section 2, we said he cannot be called, even in these instances, before a grand jury or before a closed session, but a non-reporter could be. So you have to again go back and realize you're talking about reporters.
Yes, I'm sorry. Paul, just picking up Representative Engel's suggestion. If I understand it correctly, most of the things, testimony we've had have been the tip and the spilling the beans, and the category I call hearsay, and that's protecting sources of information as opposed to actually witnessing information. If I understand here, you're in effect kind of extending and saying that the reporter or the person with these two exceptions cannot be compelled to testify those things he sees in first instance. Is that Correct. In other words, I see a distinction, maybe it's a distinction, not a difference, between sources of information where somebody gives you a tip, and that's where most of the testimony has been in the past, to where the fellow sees what he's going on, he becomes a witness like other citizens.
Well, you look at section 3, and it's correct when you talk about source if you're looking at subsection 1, section 3, but 2 talks about any unpublished information obtained by him. So if he observes something and doesn't publish it, it's still protected whether he got it from some source or not. See, the bill protects two types of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, what we were trying to do here is design an exception that where it might be important to obtain the testimony of a person, and it could be civilly or even criminally, but in very limited circumstances where even the reporter could be. And I think by the qualifications, there are some cases. For example, let's say you are a student whose head was bashed in by a police officer, and a newsman happened to have a film clip which he didn't publish. Now, under the bill as it is now, if you are the student and you're bringing a personal injury case against the city of Portland for its police activities, you might want a subpoena and get that film as evidence. That might be the best evidence of the fact of who exactly was that hit you on the head, because maybe the defense of the city is that you were hit by some other student in the melee. And yet here is a film clip that deliberately shows the helmeted officer striking you on the head. It's protected now if he didn't, if it's an outtake, use a famous word.
I learned that. Thank you.
In any event, under this, I think you could get a hold of that. And that might be the only basis you can get redress. Seems to us, with the little guy needing that help, I don't think the reporter, if you don't have that in there, the reporter will plead the privilege because he feels he must as a matter of protecting the concept of it. But in this case, we don't put him under the dilemma. We say he's not covered for it, so he probably wouldn't want to plead it. I think it's a good exception. I think if you really think about it, it's a valid type of exception. I think all of these are. C and D might be combined in some manner, and more time would give me more time to reflect on it. I'm sure the committee too.
We're going to be here in November.
What do you think?
I quit. I'm going to leave pretty soon.
But not on this bill, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll call on our next witness. We have three more witnesses, and I'd like to point out that we would like to ask the witnesses if they do not have anything newer than what we have heard, that if they would kind of limit it in scope so that we won't be here until 11 o'clock again this week, but we would like to get out here much earlier. So with that, I'll call on Professor John Strong of the University Law School.
My name is John Strong, and I'm a professor of law at the University of Oregon, where my principal specialty is the law of evidence, which I've taught there and at other law schools for about the past 9 years. And when I've said that much, I imagine that those members of the committee that are lawyers will immediately guess what my general preferences on this subject are, because they'll know that evidence professors are always very hostile to rules of privilege, at least until a very clear-cut need can be shown for those. It's true, even though it does give us more to teach, which is in itself a benefit, of course. But despite that, the principal reason for this hostility, which is traditional and has gone back a good many years in time, is that any rational system of evidence has to have as its single most important objective the disclosure of the truth in its fullest and most complete form. Any rule of privilege is fundamentally in opposition to that. Now, I was struck by Mr. Brandt's comment that Senator Paisley read earlier, I hate to disagree with such an eminent scholar on points of history, but I must demur to a couple of his assertions there with respect to the reasons for various privilege. I think, incidentally, Oregon probably holds the all-time record for the creation of privileges. I think the state has more statutorily created privileges than any other state in the Union, which I personally would not view as an enviable record. But reference to Mr. Brandt's comments, saying that if the press had gotten this as early as the medical profession, their positions would be reversed today. Almost all privileges, except that for attorney-client, are of 20th century origin. These are all new, so it would not have, the doctors did not succeed because they were that far ahead in time. I also would try to rebut in advance the assertion that's commonly made, and I think Mr. Brandt also made, that lawyers are very zealous to protect themselves with a privilege, but not to extend it to anybody else. For my own part, I would say I would rebut that because I'm not really very convinced of the complete wisdom of the attorney-client privilege in the scope, or in the scope that it's generally recognized today. Well, not to take too much of the committee's time, I would suggest perhaps what I might be able to contribute that would be new would be something on the order of the traditional analysis that people in my area, at least, apply to any question of privilege. And as you'll see from the statement, the conclusion I would come to in this particular case is that there is a privilege warranted in this instance, but that there is a feasible way to limit it in such a manner as to achieve the social objective, which seems to be most paramount right at this time in history, without unduly expanding the privilege in an unnecessary manner. I think the analysis of, as I say, people in my particular field with reference to privilege questions generally is that you have to have really two things, two considerations have to be balanced in the creation of these things. First, you do need some sort of overriding social necessity or social policy which you consider to be superior to the interest of obtaining truth in the courts. And truth in the courts is a very serious objective. Certainly lack of it can have very serious consequences to the litigants, including defendants in criminal cases. I take it there would probably be no doubt on anyone's part that there is a compelling social policy in this particular context. The interest in a society of the sort ours is in having a press that can supply the fullest possible coverage of public events. So there's really no question about that. The real question is, how far do you have to go? Does the privilege, in effect, have a sufficient capacity to promote that policy to warrant the cost that you're going to pay for it? Now, in this particular instance, I might be able to contribute something in the way of comparison of this privilege to other rules of privilege generally. The newsman's privilege is generally, at least in the materials I've seen, the statements I've heard tonight, generally urged to be supported on the theory that the existence of such a privilege will promote the willingness of sources to supply news without fear of disclosure of their identities. Now, that is a very traditional basis for privileges. The physician-patient privilege, the attorney-client privilege, the priest-penitent privilege all rest on a similar basis. That is a rather shaky basis for the reason that in order to rely upon a privilege, you have to know about it. And very few people involved in these relationships, attorney-client, doctor-patient, priest-penitent, employer-secretary, stenographer, as we have in this state,
very few of these people know about the existence of the privilege. The possible exception, this is the one area in which I think the lawyers do have a claim to being sui generis, is that they do know, or at least most of them do, and they therefore can communicate this to the client and thus encourage the disclosure. In point of fact, the only empirical evidence that I have seen to date, and I know this has been cited to the committee before, is Professor Blasey's article in the Michigan Law Review, in which he conducted a substantial survey of newsmen in the increasing number of states which currently have shield laws. And he found that the situation which has generally been assumed to exist in the connection with the knowledge of that holders of privileges have about them also exists with respect to newsmen in those states. Over 50% of the newsmen in those shield states were not sure whether there was a privilege. 14%, in excess of 14%, erroneously believed that they had no privilege when they did have one. Now, if you can assume or if you can go with those statistics or that empirical study, you would have to conclude that, first off, newsmen would not be very well informed about this, at least they are not today. Secondly, their sources will be even less informed, probably, since they have less to do with the privilege generally than the newsman. So, from that standpoint, it would be somewhat questionable whether the privilege would serve the purpose for which it's intended. Now, I think it's only fair to extend to the press the same assumption that we extend to other privileged groups, and that is that, as I say, that same argument would knock out most of the privileges which are currently recognized. And so you might assume, well, let's say this is an unusual case and that the press will know about it and be able to communicate it. Here again you have an interesting contrast between the newsman's privilege, or at least some versions of it that I have heard suggested, and other privileges. You assume that members of the press will know. Is this the type of a privilege which would inspire confidence in a source? Now it's interesting, I think, by way of contrast, to notice that most, all but one, of the other currently recognized privileges, including the attorney-client, physician-patient, priest-tenant, are held by the communicator. They are held by the parties who divulge the information. Information cannot be released without the consent of those persons. They are not held by the receiver. The only exception to that is the current privilege in favor of the state to suppress the identity of police informers. That privilege is held by the state and can be waived by it. In teaching this, I have always suggested that if I were a police informer, that the existence of that particular privilege would not give me great confidence. That if the case were important enough to the prosecuting authorities, that my identity would not be divulged. And I think that would be somewhat similar in the case of any newsman's privilege, which was held by the newsman. One thing for a source to have a privilege. It's another thing to have a privilege waivable or claimable at the option of the receiver of the information. I would finally point out, as to the theory, this particular theory alleged to underlie the privilege, that frequently overlooked that privilege is a very rough tool to accomplish this kind of social end. The privilege in itself is purely evidentiary. It suppresses the evidence in a court, which is the one place, or at least a very important place, where the facts are needed, maybe not the only place. It cannot do much more than that. It does not purport to compel silence elsewhere. And even in more tightly regulated professions such as medicine and law, it's sometimes alleged by, I say alleged by persons, that there are disclosures at the country club which could not be compelled in court, so that the existence of a privilege by itself, without meaningful ethical or other sanctions behind sanctioning disclosure elsewhere,
is not a basis for reliance on the part of the communicator. Another factor which I think would tend to diminish the effect of such a privilege, even if it were recognized. Well, this might suggest that I would oppose any privilege in this area at all. Certainly, I would like to see some of the existing privileges done away with. However, rather paradoxically, perhaps, I would favor a privilege in this particular instance. But I think the whole problem, or at least as far as I've been able to read and study it, is perhaps overly simple to me. I am very struck by the fact that virtually all of the cases, and all of the cases, even if you go back to the first ones in the late 19th century, first reported, almost all of them involve a particular context in which the privilege is thought to be invoked, and that is the context which has been repeatedly referred to by other witnesses here tonight as illustrating the need for the privilege, and that is the context in which prosecuting authorities, persons charged with the responsibility of enforcing the criminal law, have sought to use the press as an arm for that enforcement, trying in effect to get the press to do their job for them. Now, I would be totally out of sympathy with any such attempt as that. I think this is, in fact, demeaning to the press, destructive of its image in the public eye. It is unnecessary in the sense that the social ends involved there can be certainly served in other ways through the provision of more effective law enforcement agencies and so on. The conclusion I would reach from all of this, I think, is based upon the premise that you don't want to make a privilege any broader and incur the damaging effects of it any broader than what you need in order to achieve your end. And in this instance, I would suppose that the end which is basically sought is the termination of this kind of use of the press, for this particular purpose. And that can be achieved in a very simple fashion. Again, one of the suggestions that Professor Blasey made in his Michigan Law Review article, and one on which he questioned members of the press, was how about a privilege which would preclude the summoning of newsmen before any kind of investigative body, grand juries, legislative committees, any kind of investigative operation. Why not, and in other contexts, no privilege? He expected, as he concedes in there, he expected to find a favorable response among the press to that question, because he expected that this would, rather than some other type of privilege which is riddled with all sorts of very complicated and legalistic exceptions running down to 4 and 5 subparagraphs, if you were a newsman explaining to a source what the extent of the privilege was, you have to drag out the bill and start explaining this thing. It would be very complicated, and when you got done, you still wouldn't be sure. Blasey assumed then that this sort of a privilege, which is mechanically limited, would be very clear-cut, easily explained, and that the press therefore could rely upon it with considerable assurance and explain it to sources in such a way as to make it meaningful to them. The press, members of the press that responded to the survey, did not prefer that type of a privilege. Understandably, they preferred a blanket privilege. Even of the types of limited privilege acts that were suggested to them, they did not prefer that one. I do prefer that one. I think that is just the ticket to accomplish the objective sought. I think that would take care of 90% of the cases that you have had and will have in the future. It would not incur loss in the types of cases in which the loss would be most significant and have the most significant impact upon affected parties. It would be very easy for the courts to enforce, because the distinction is a mechanical one and it is not based upon any complicated evidentiary standard with respect to burdens of proof with respect to all sorts of different kinds of exceptions and differing factual situations with respect to, which may vary with respect to the need for the evidence. Finally, and not the least, it would be very easy to teach because this would not require any fine discrimination. Also, as I say, I think this would have the benefit for the press, so perhaps they would not take a similar view of this matter, that it could be easily conveyed to sources and thus relate back to the initial argument supporting the privilege, that it is supposed to inspire confidence. And I have never had my confidence inspired by something that I could not understand, and I doubt that many news sources would feel that way either. I think I'll conclude my, I do have in my written statement one short comment about one of the existing bills. My basic preference, however, would not be for any bill that I have personally seen today, but rather for a privilege such as I've disclosed. Incidentally, I might mention one other thing, though. You may have, members of the committee may have seen this in the paper. Professor Blasey, who I've referred to several times and whose work you've been referred to, you may have noticed, testified before Congress last Friday on the question of a federally created newsman's privilege. He had rather coyly not revealed his own personal position in conjunction with the publication of his empirical research, leaving everybody to guess just what conclusions he would draw from all that. And he finally, I guess he chose the most dramatic moment for this, but he finally did commit himself before Congress, and his basic position would be the same as what I have expressed, that is, that he feels the basic problem is the subpoenaing of newsmen in an attempt to use them as ancillary or auxiliary evidence gatherers for the police force, and that that is what is inherently offensive about the whole operation. That is what should be put a stop to. That should be the function of the privilege. He would achieve the results in a slightly different manner. He would, I take it, did advocate a divestiture bill with such onerous divestiture provisions that district attorneys would be discouraged from ever trying to invoke them.
First,
I
think it's very difficult for me because I have to take a position for or against one of the constituents down there. It's very difficult.
I wondered what you would, you said you adopted Mr. Brandt's statement as a constituent. I wondered if I would get similar treatment.
The answer to that is plain, no. I apologize in advance. What I'm really going to do is quibble with you about whether or not the medical one is a 20th century origin. You have said that he is wrong because he has said it's not a 20th century origin. As I'm sure you know, over the lawyer-client privilege is out of the common law, and the physician-patient privilege is not from the common law, but it is more statutory.
Entirely statutory.
On the other hand, it is not 20th century in origin. In 1862, Judge Deedy brought to this legislature, I think in a manuscript form, borrowing from Greenleaf's code on evidence, a more or less complete code. I'm not positive that it was a part of that 1862 legal code, but I think it was. And I know that it was litigated, and the lawyer lost his case because he commented before the jury on the failure of the physician to testify regarding the person in 1887. So it's my, I submit it in behalf of Mr. Brandt that an Oregon police did it in the 20th century of Florida.
I think, if I have wronged Mr. Brandt, I certainly apologize. I've deprived him of 13 years there, but I would adhere to my earlier statement. Maybe I should more accurately have said it is generally a 20th century. Or, of course, this is created state by state, and in most states was not enacted until fairly recently, in some states very recently.
Being
a product
of the Oregon Law School, I don't know it all. Mr. Chairman, if I could go ahead.
That would not be the case.
Yeah. If I could go ahead just a little bit. Your analysis is that it's a privilege.
It occurs to me that most of the testimony we've heard is not in the vein of a privilege. It doesn't belong to some third party who's being protected by a professional privilege. Instead, it is an exemption for the professional so that he can continue to gain information and knowledge. It is the basis of trust. His unwillingness to disclose the information is the basis of the trust to disclose in the professional. The source is not going to trust the professional unless the professional has the exemption, that's the argument. So it's not a privilege, it is in fact an exemption to make that profession operate properly. And the privilege analysis just doesn't fit.
Well, I guess I've already expressed my inherent disagreement with that.
Well, you say it should be treated as a privilege. I'm saying the evidence doesn't consider that a privilege, and it isn't analogous because there's not a third.
Well, I know that one of the bills includes it in the ORS section with all the other privileges. To me, the and it has been certainly treated as such by the states which have enacted similar statutes in the past. It is treated as such. Most of the literature on the subject. I don't see really, I think the rationale expressed is the same as would justify privileges. I guess, in other words, don't see the distinction.
You pointed out, but there's no third party being protected, belongs to the professional, not to the.
Right, and that also is true, as I said, in the government informer situation, which is also treated as a
Senator, carrying on, President Strong and Senator Bailey's concern, I think we do run into a lot of a problem, and I think Mr. Brandt could come up with eloquently points out the confusion when you try to analogize this privilege to the rest of them, because there's a third party involved, and the question is, before I go to the thing, are you aware of any, and let's get away from privilege, because I don't really think it's privilege, any other provision in law, the privileges protect the what is said, not really the who. Now, the attorney client, they go and they protect what the transaction, but the reporter privilege or shield or whatever it is, obviously doesn't go to the what, it goes to the who, because of what you read about in the paper. Would we not be better off to abandon the trying to get into ORS 44040 and hit it head on in the question of whether the public interest demands this protection? Yeah, because we really get hung up on the analogy, don't you think?
No. There are, to answer your question directly, I think I mentioned there is the one clearly comparable situation, that is the police informant, which is recognized privilege by common law, which protects identity. There is a question with respect to attorney-client. That's one of the perplexing problems with the attorney-client privilege, whether the privilege protects identity or whether the identity of the client is...
Oh, yes, but you can't. If you say the third person exercise, he has to come forward to exercise his...
But that's the problem.
Yeah, well,
the attorney can claim on his behalf, certainly, if called upon to divulge, and the question is as to the threshold fact, does he have to show a client with a face, or can he say, I have a client?
He can claim it.
He can claim it on behalf of the client. He cannot waive it. It is not his privilege, nor could he insist upon it if the client sought it to disclose.
Excuse me, Chairman, I'm it has nothing to do with the bill, but I'm interested. You mean the lawyer can say
notice.
I thought I meant that for you. The lawyer could say this is attorney client privilege, because I think this is analogous to what we're talking about. This is attorney client privilege, and so let's see your client to the witness. I won't tell you. Is that the way it's
Well, as I say, this is one of the very difficult problems. Let me give you an actual case that occurred some years back. Client consults with his accountant and finds out that he has shorted on his income tax. And therefore, to avoid any possible further penalties, he consults the lawyer and says, what should I do? And the lawyer says, pay up your deficiency give me the money and I'll send it in to the IRS. And he did this, and then the IRS was very interested to know who it was that he was representing sending in this money. And this is exactly the kind of case. Now that, to me, is exactly analogous to this type of thing. That is a use of a profession as a fact-finding adjunct. If you allowed, or if you did not allow the privilege to be claimed in that instance, it would be easy to pick up the leading tax firm in town and subpoena them in and say, who are you representing lately? Then you would know who to audit that year, if you were the IRS. That would be too easy. But I think this is a very close analogy, and I disagree with Senator Stately on it.
I only went on the basis of your analysis of your testimony and that of others. They really talk about it as being owned not by the person being protected, but by the professional using information.
I take it maybe we're just quibbling over a definition here. You do not conceive of a privilege as potentially possessible by one other than the communicating party. Is that the is that your definition of privilege that we're getting at?
You have pointed out that all privileges can be waived by someone who communicated to the professional. And this is one that can't be. The effect of it is the same, because the guy came in and said, I told the reporter that, and the reporter would still say, same mom, and won't say whether that is true or not.
Right, I believe I did notice one bill is not the one bill.
There is a privilege. Yes. It's one tradition of one thing.
Right.
Maybe all this should have come before the Judiciary Committee. Your attorneys are enjoying themselves so much.
Get a refresher course without paying for this.
Are there further questions for Professor
Shaw? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. Our next witness is Virgil Smith from the Oregonian.
Gentlemen, I'm not to the editor of the Oregonian, but I'm here on my own. I was not asked or told here to come here. This is just suggested. And I've thought about this matter of secondary, as we call it, off and on for a long time, about 40 years. And there have been times, at least in the last 20 years, when I've been a little alarmed, angered by the action of courts. It seems to me arbitrary and unreasonable and restricting our freedom. News photographers barred from courthouses, not just courtrooms, courthouses. While filing away some time attending a trial, it turned out to be boredom. I noticed that the judge would nod from time to time on the bench. The attorneys noticed this and they would raise their voices. But when I came that I happened to nod, I was shaken awake by a bailiff who sternly advised me that dozing was not permitted in the courtroom. I wish I had been sufficiently alert to tell him to tell it to the judge. So my thoughts have tended to be in the direction of restraint of courts for the government and their efforts to fence us out rather than towards granting us protection and privilege. These are, I suppose, the two faces of one coin. Now, in my repertorial days, I never was confronted with any harrowing demand that I reveal sources of information. True, I once was subpoenaed to testify that the source of information which I gave in the story I had written was really the source. I was somewhat embarrassed because it wasn't. In explanation, it once was a tenet of newspaper practice that a reporter never saw or knew anything. Everything had to be attributed. And following this, I had attributed as being told by another person who was there something which I had seen myself. A remnant of this old practice cropped up in a story out of California just last week in which a reporter covering a fire said, a witness said the building next door caught fire. Now, Thank goodness we don't do that anymore, or we try not to. I once uncovered an attempt by a sheriff and a district attorney to protect a wealthy friend and contributor from a hit-and-run charge involving the death of a little black boy. Now, nobody tried to find out from me where I got the tip. They did succeed to take the county printing away from it. But it seems that... it seems that until recently, it was taken for granted that reporters would refuse a request for a source of information. And it was useless, but there was no way to try to make them tell. Things have changed. In my work, hardly a day goes by that I don't get some proposition, some offer of information, with a request that the source of information will never be revealed. We actually get a lot of news this way. We get out a lot of it. Some ordinary news, some news of crime and various other things. However, many of these calls are phony. They're from cranks, drunks, mentally ill. But we can't always tell immediately. Last week, I had a call from a man who said he wanted to give us information about the Cosa Nostra operation in Portland. He said he didn't have much time, that his life was in danger. Well, we arranged a midnight rendezvous in a bar with signals for the recognition of my reporter and the recognition of this man and all that sort of thing. They met, had a beer, got into a taxi, drove around, made various stops, usually at a bar where they had another beer. Eventually to a sleazy hotel, the witness man disappeared, emerging a little later with a thick folder of papers, which he explained laid out the entire operation. They got in the taxi, and my man, thumbing through the folder, was skeptical, because these papers seemed to deal with bolts of materials and cutting cloth and things like that. The informant explained that it was in code, and the next they would ask to pick up the code book. And this required more stops and more bars. Eventually, my man decided he was being taken for a ride by a slick young man who wanted somebody to talk to him to buy him beer. Now, the previous week, a young man wanted to tell me information about an arsonist. After a couple of meetings with him, we decided that he was dingy. But you never know. But both these incidents, and I could cite many more, had the potential of a confrontation with authorities over the source of information. Now, in view of the direction the court seemed to be going, I have become convinced that we do need some protection. This conviction has come in part from the publicity and the discussion of this very subject. I think that in view of this, the sources of information will be drying up unless some protection is written into law. As far as I know, reporters have hung tough so far. They haven't told. But the way the courts are going, this may happen. And if it does happen, believe me, I think the word gets around to the people that reporters may talk. Now, as it is today, with these calls, we usually try to get a name. In most cases, a simple assurance that the name will not surface. We do guess the name. I fear this will no longer be true unless we get a law, unless we get something on there that will assure people that we're not going to reveal the name. Now, I see difficulties. It seems to me that a privilege or a protection or immunity law, call it what you will ultimately need some definition of what and who is covered. And I don't think that you can do that right off. Right at the beginning, I think you're going to have to write something that's pretty general and see what happens. Because when you're going to ultimately write a definition of the press or the media, I think that almost an inevitable further step maybe a license provision. And I think that would be a disaster. So I think that, after all, there are not many of these things come up. And I think that something general, or you can start out with something general, and then see what happens. Maybe it won't be no good. Maybe we decide we don't have it. How many we had here? They said it might be one. And I've never had one in more than 40 years. But I say, I know what the courts have been doing, the way the courts have been moving. I think that we do need something. Now, I'll throw out a thought. It's been rattling around in my mind. I haven't any idea of its merits. I haven't thought it through. It's just a thought. It's this. That by law or otherwise, it would have to be some law, that the media be required to set up a board or a commission of its own members. When a situation then arose in which the district attorney or the court wanted to report or reveal his source and report or refuse, this matter would be referred to this board. Let it decide whether or not justice and the public good requires the source be revealed. Take away from the courts the right to send a reporter to jail in such cases. Let his peers be the judge. Isn't that the way you lawyers do it? Now, personally, I wouldn't object to what they call absolute privilege or absolute immunity, but neither would I ask for it. I personally don't believe a reporter should have the privilege of consorting with criminals, writing about them and their crimes, becoming an accessory after the fact or even before, all without restraint. I don't want a practicing criminal on my staff, no more than I want a reporter who is doing his job labeled as a criminal or treated as such. Anybody want to ask any questions?
Questions for Mr. Smith? I have to say one thing. I understood every word you said.